Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to MTC. I'm pleased to see you all here today, and I'd like to introduce the Prime Minister, David Cameron, who will talk to us for a few minutes. David Cameron.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And can I say how delighted I am to be at this extraordinary centre where so many great things are happening, and also to be here on a day when we're talking about apprenticeships and expanding apprenticeships. Because we have got a long-term economic plan to secure this country's future. To cut the deficit, cut taxes, create more jobs, cap welfare, reduce immigration, and deliver the best schools and skills for our young people. That is our plan, and it's working. You can see that in the economic growth figures, the 1.3 million new jobs, the 25 million people who'll pay less in income tax, the 400,000 new businesses now operating in our country, and yes, in the new apprenticeships being announced today. New, more rigorous employer-led apprenticeships are being extended to 29 new occupations, from law and high-tech engineering to tourism and retail, giving thousands of young people the chance to develop new skills that will help to secure their future. And we're on track to have 2 million people start apprenticeships over the course of this Parliament. But I haven't come here today to reel off statistics. I'm here today to talk about what this plan is really all about, what it's all for. Too often we've given the impression that we're just about fixing problems rather than changing things for a purpose. But that completely misunderstands what we're trying to do. This is more than some turnaround team of accountants rescuing a failing business. Yes, of course, we want Britain to be a success in this modernized, globalized world. We want to be a country that succeeds in what I call the global race. But it's not just what we're doing that matters, it's why we're doing it. It's all about values. And the most important value right now, after a difficult time for our country, is giving people a sense of economic security and peace of mind. Take our mission to cut the deficit. Now, of course, cutting the deficit matters for our economy. Higher deficits mean more debt and higher mortgage rates, with more people in fear of losing their homes. But there's something even more fundamental here about our values. If we don't get to grips with the deficit now, we're going to be passing a greater and greater burden of debt to our children. We would effectively be saying that more and more of their hard-earned future income should be wasted on paying off the bill that we leave them. Do we really want to be the ones who responded to a crisis by putting off to tomorrow what we should have done today? Can we really teach our children the importance of being responsible and at the same time shirk the most fundamental responsibility of all? Now, some of our opponents seem to think that we can. They think we can carry on spending and borrowing more and more, whatever the consequences for our children. But I say no. Racking up more and more debts for our children is irresponsible. It is not fair, it is not right, and I'm not prepared to do it. Imagine looking your children in the eye and trying to explain why we crippled their future with our debt. I couldn't do that, and I'm sure you couldn't either. We all want the same for our children, a secure future and a chance to make something of their lives. But they won't get that future unless we cut the deficit now. So that's the first part of our plan. What about the second, cutting taxes? This isn't some ideological commitment for a smaller state. Again, it's actually about our values. We believe in helping people keep more of the money that they earn. It's the right thing to do. And we should be clear. There is no such thing as government money. It's your money, taxpayer money. It's not my money. It's not George Osborne's money, not the government's money. It is your money, hard-working people's money. The money that belongs to people who get up in the morning, come rain or shine, and put in a shift on the factory floor or in the office. And there's no question who spends that money best. It is you, the taxpayer, not the government. So it's wrong for government to take a single penny more of your money than we absolutely need. And there's a bit of an attitude problem here that can make me pretty angry. Some people talk as if the sums of money the government spends are so big that it also doesn't really matter about the odd extra pound here or there. I think that is totally irresponsible. You wouldn't take that approach to managing your money, and neither should we in the government. Now, that is important at the best of times, but it's more important than ever when families are feeling the squeeze. Because every bit of government waste we can cut, every efficiency we can make, that is money we can give back to you. A bit of extra cash that can help a dad afford those trainers for his son, or help a mum celebrate her daughter's birthday with a meal out. Having more money in our pockets is what gives everyone that sense of financial security and peace of mind. It is what enables us to provide for our families and feel more confident about the future. Now, the same is true about the third part of our plan, our mission to create more jobs. Now, take Demi Owoseji, whose small business restores old furniture. She's been helped by our startup loan scheme to develop a customer-friendly website and branch into new areas like a rental range, with customers now including Jimmy Choo. Where is Demi? I think she's here today. Well, I remember meeting her in Downing Street. She started creating her first jobs, so soon she'll be helped by our employment allowance that will give her a £2,000 cashback on the jobs that she creates. And from next year, she won't have to pay a penny in national insurance for anyone she hires who is under the age of 21. But you know what really matters is not the help that we've given Demi, but the help that she is giving others. Our opponents said we would see 1 million jobs disappear. But in fact, entrepreneurs like Demi have helped to create 1.3 million more jobs today than there were in 2010. Now, we see the new job numbers every month when the figures come out. But again, what matters far more than the numbers is the dignity that people get from having a job. There is nothing like the pride of the first time you get that paycheck. It gives you the chance of a more fulfilled life. It gives you the opportunity to be more independent. Most important of all, it gives you a sense of security and the peace of mind that you can support yourself and your family. And that is what I want from this plan more than anything: sustainable and well-paid jobs. Now, we're not going to get there by attacking businesses or putting their taxes up. We need to be in the business of helping business so they create the jobs that we all depend on. And it is working. We're seeing a revival of manufacturing exports and a growth in small businesses. More jobs being created each month, and better paid jobs too. Last week, the Low Pay Commission recommended the minimum wage should increase to £6.50 an hour. That would be the first above inflation increase in 6 years. And it's something that's only affordable because of the difficult decisions we've taken with our long-term economic plan. Now, of course, the numbers matter, but what matters even more is what it means for hardworking people. It means that as we recover from the Great Recession, hardworking people on the minimum wage who've suffered during the tough times, they can know that they will share in this recovery. So yes, I look forward to accepting this recommendation. Restoring the value of the minimum wage is a vital part of how we secure a recovery for all, with economic security for every working family in Britain. Now let me turn to those out of work, because the fourth part of our plan is about capping welfare and reducing immigration. At the end of the so-called boom years, there were around 5 million people in our country of working age, but on out-of-work benefits. Almost 1.5 million people had spent most of the last decade out of work. And the number of households where no one had ever worked had nearly doubled. And this happened at the same time as the largest wave of migration in our country's history. Now, I don't care whether you are the leader of the Labour Party or the leader of a church. This kind of failure is just wrong. It's wrong to let our own people do nothing with no purpose in their life dependent on benefits. It's wrong that we open our doors and communities to such rapid levels of immigration that they can't manage. And it's wrong that we ask British taxpayers to fund this situation with their hard-earned money. As I've said before, immigration and welfare are two sides of the same coin, and we've got to fix both of them. Let's start with immigration. Last week, figures show what a big task we still face, but things are starting to change. In just 5 years, between 2005 and 2010, for every British person who fell out of work, almost two foreign nationals gained employment. But over the past year, almost 90%, 9 out of 10 of the increases in employment we've seen has been for UK nationals. We've cut migration from outside the EU to its lowest level since 1998. And we're making it harder for migrants to come here and claim benefits or access public services without earning that entitlement first. And the idea of allowing new countries to join the European Union with immediate, unfettered access to our labour markets, that is never going to happen again. But it's not just about controlling migration. As I said, the other side of the coin is welfare. And again, it comes back to a fundamental question of values. Last week, I went to a dinner in honor of D-Day veterans, most of them now in their 90s. And one of the veterans told me about how he'd come back from the war. He went to the labor exchange, but he couldn't immediately find a job. But eventually he got offered a job at Ford in Dagenham, and it was hard work, but he was proud to do it. He said to me, "I was able to work, they offered me a job, and I had a responsibility to take it. There wasn't an option to say, 'No thanks, I'll take the benefits instead.'" And he looked me in the eye and he said, "Why can't we go back to that?" And I agree with him. I've always been clear that those who can't work will always be supported. But those who can work have a responsibility to do so. And the welfare system must never, ever take that responsibility away from them. Why should some people work every hour God sends to try and make ends meet, only to see money taken out of their wages to support people who could work, but who choose not to? That's why if people turn down job offers, their benefits will be cut. I want Britain to be a country where people are able to get on, to stand on their own two feet, and to build a better life for themselves and their family. I want a Britain where we reward those who work hard, who play by the rules, and who do the right thing. And that is what our long-term economic plan is all about. Not just making the numbers add up, but doing what is fair and what is right. You don't create economic security with handouts. You do that with the dignity, the independence, and yes, the pay packet that comes with a job. And that takes me to the final part of the plan, delivering the best schools and skills for our young people. Now, nothing I've spoken about today is more important for our future than that. Education is the best inoculation against unemployment. It's what gives our children the skills they need to compete, to get a job, to secure their future. And it's what gives our country the platform from which to innovate, to create new products, and to take on the world. So frankly, an economic plan that doesn't include delivering a first-class, world-class education system, that would be no economic plan at all. Now, some people look at what we're doing in education and think we're driven by some deep-seated ideology. And I've got to say, that is total nonsense. Again, we are driven by our values. Values like discipline, because we know that no child can learn in chaos. Values like rigor, because we know that dumbing down, that cheats our children of their future. Values like excellence for all, because we should be ambitious for every child, not just some children. And a focus on the fundamentals, because there isn't a job in the world where you don't need to read or add up properly. But you know the most important value that I believe we need to bring to education? It is faith in our teachers. Of course, we must never excuse failure, and we should never shy away from difficult conversations about the quality of teaching in our country, if it ever lets children down. But if you look at our academies or our free schools program, there is a single thread running through it. Giving teachers the freedom to get on and teach, giving them control over how their schools are run, and trusting them to get on with the job. But it's not just about what happens at school, it's what about happens after school as well. Now, I want all school leavers to have a rite of passage to further training or education. And that's why the apprenticeships, like those being announced today, are so important. Take Aidan Rogers, who showed me around the Rolls-Royce apprenticeship scheme and their academy last year, and who's with us today. Aidan told me he was studying for a degree while also earning and learning his trade. And what you said to me was this: you love being able to say, I started as an apprentice, because it's something that gives you instant respect and credibility. And Aidan describes how his apprenticeship has given him the confidence to communicate ideas and the opportunity to apply everything he's learned in a hands-on industrial setting. As the winner of the EEF's Outstanding Achievement Award for a first-year apprentice, Aidan is already aspiring to the day when he's in a senior position and he's getting the skills to give him every chance of that future. Now, I want all our young people to have the skills and the opportunity to aspire to that great future. And that's why delivering the best schools and skills is right at the heart of our long-term economic plan. So yes, we are sorting out the economy and we're getting those numbers to add up, but we're doing something much more than that. We are doing what is right for our country, what is right for our children, what is right for our future. Because I want us to build a better Britain where we can look after future generations, where people can meet their obligations and provide for their families, and where together we can secure a better, more independent future for all our people. That is my fundamental mission in politics, to deliver economic security and peace of mind for every family in Britain. And that really is what our long-term economic plan is all about. Thank you very much for listening. I look forward to taking your questions. Thank you for the welcome today. Okay, I think we've got a roving microphone, so questions, and if you could say who you are and where you're from. Start over here on the right. Hold on a second, there's a microphone. It's a bit... Thank you.
I'm Stefan Herbst. I'm from Germany. You talk about regulating immigration by immigration control. This makes a lot of problems with us getting specialized people in here. But the other way around, why would you not introduce a British identity card that works in Germany quite well for regulating illegal working and looking after the, for example, council tax and these stuff?
Well, first of all, very warm welcome to having you here. I hope you recognize that this center, in many ways, is modeled on the German Fraunhofer Institutes that were so successful in building up Germany's manufacturing, technological, and industrial strength, and that is exactly what we aim to do here in the United Kingdom. I'm not in favor of identity cards. The last government was looking at identity cards, and we scrapped that work because I don't think it should be necessary to have an ID card for every single person in the country when we already have so many different forms of identity already. If we want to crack down on illegal working, we should crack down on illegal working. If we want to make sure our borders are more secure, we can make our borders more secure. You don't need an identity card system to do those things, but I'm absolutely convinced we need to do more, particularly to stop companies paying below the minimum wage, to deal with the curse of modern slavery in our country, to make sure that gangmasters are properly licensed. More work needs to be done on those fronts, and more work will be done. The point I was making about immigration is that the first responsibility of a government should be to educate, train up our own workforce, and make sure our welfare system is prioritizing people into work. Then, if at the end of that there are still skills shortages and needs for our country, then of course immigration is one way of filling those needs. But what we had, particularly over the last 10 years, is a system where we left, as I put it, 5 million people in our own country on out-of-work benefits while having an enormous mass migration to fill in skilled jobs that we really should have been doing more to fill ourselves. So welfare, education, immigration, those three issues go together. And if you crack them together, you can actually create a far more prosperous country with a much better spread of income, wealth and prosperity. I think it's ITV. There's a microphone coming for you, Libby.
Libby Wiener, ITV News. Prime Minister, if you really want people to trust you, why has it taken you 3 weeks to come clean over the arrest of a top aide over allegations of child pornography? And how much of a blow has it been to you personally losing his services?
Well, first of all, I have to be careful what I say about this issue because obviously a criminal investigation is underway. Obviously, when I heard these allegations, I was profoundly shocked and I remain profoundly shocked today. In terms of the release of this information, I don't think it would be right to preemptively brief out a criminal investigation, and that's why we did not do that. But as soon as questions were asked, as questions would inevitably be asked, we have given very full and straightforward answers, which is absolutely the right way to handle this. I've been clear right along, and I was told about this issue pretty much as soon as it was discovered. I've been very clear that we must handle this in an absolutely correct way, and I'm satisfied that that's what Number 10 Downing Street has done. Lady next door.
Anish Grastana, Sky News. Prime Minister, are fears about the impact on the British economy stopping us from taking tough enough action on Ukraine? And just on Patrick Rock, is it a blow to lose such a senior member of your policy unit, given how important that unit is in driving these policies that you've been talking about today?
Well, I think I've said what I want to say about Patrick Rock. Obviously, he did play an important role at Downing Street. He's resigned that position. And as I said, I was very shocked when I heard about those allegations. But this is now a matter of a criminal investigation, so I don't think it'd be right to say any more on that subject. On the issue of the Ukraine and our attitude towards Russia, look, we should be very clear about this. Britain is working with our allies and partners, with America, with France and Germany, the leaders of which I spoke to yesterday, through the European Union, to make sure we take a very clear and strong approach in two vital respects. First of all, to say to the people of Ukraine, we back your ability to choose your own future. You should be able to choose the path you take, and you'll have the support of countries like Britain, France and Germany, the European Union and America in doing so. And we'll obviously be working through the IMF and other organizations to give Ukraine and the people of Ukraine the chance to choose that future. We'll also be sending a very clear message, and are sending a very clear message, to the government in Russia that what has happened is unacceptable, that failing to respect the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine, that is not an acceptable way to behave. And we have said very clearly that there will be costs and consequences diplomatically, politically, and economically from that, the decisions that have been taken. And we need to send an even more clear message that if there are further incursions into the Ukraine's territorial integrity and sovereignty, then further steps would have to be taken. That is absolutely clear. I think, with respect, the broadcasters should focus on what the government says and what the government does rather than anything that is contained on a piece of paper held by someone standing in Downing Street. Unfortunate and regrettable, though that incident is. Any further questions? Yes, gentlemen here. Microphone's coming to you, sir.
Thank you. Prime Minister, how successful do you think free schools have been?
I think free schools have been very successful. If we take the big macro picture, you can see, I think I'm right from memory, that two-thirds of free schools are marked excellent or good, outstanding or good, which is a higher percentage than is the case for other state schools. Remember, free schools are schools within the state sector, schools that you do not need to pay for to send your children to. And when you think that free schools have only been going for a maximum of 2.5 years, some of them for less than that, the fact that two-thirds of them are outstanding or good, I think actually is a great testament to them. I mean, here in the West Midlands, I remember being at the opening of the Perry Beaches new school, which has many things in common with the free schools we're talking about. So I'm a big supporter of this. Basically, what it enables is that teachers, parents, businesses, organisations that have got a proposal for a great school that's going to provide a great education are able to bring that forward in the state sector. We don't have to see that sort of innovation and creativity only in the independent sector. We can have it in the state sector as well. Now, obviously, there have been one or two examples of free schools that have not worked out, or that have failed. And I would argue there, that does not mean the policy is a failure. What it means is you've got to intervene quickly and deal with those schools. And actually, arguably, we've been faster to intervene with failing free schools than perhaps previous governments were intervening with failing state schools. I think with Michael Gove in charge, we do have a Secretary of State who will not tolerate failure for very long, because we shouldn't allow a school to have poor results and give a poor service year after year, because every year it goes on, it is failing another generation of pupils. So early intervention, tough floor standards is very important in our education system. Lady here.
Thank you, Prime Minister. Councillor Catherine Lawrence, Rugby Borough Council. We have just set our budget. For the fifth consecutive year, we've frozen council tax. Not only that, but we've put money back into people's pockets by giving a 3% rebate, which is the first time that's happened for Rugby Borough. Perhaps you'd like to congratulate our councillors on what an excellent job they're doing. But further than that, perhaps you would... Perhaps you would like to find other ways to support councillors who are keeping the cost of living down for their residents, and perhaps encourage other councils who have put their council taxes up to follow our example. No, thank you.
I will certainly congratulate you on that, because it is absolutely in line with what I'm saying. If you think about it, you have made a choice in Rugby Borough Council, which is you've decided to constrain your own budgets in order to charge your residents less. If you've frozen it over the period of this government, that is something like a 15% cut. 20, thank you very much. My local council's managed 15%, you've done 20%. But that is a serious assistance to people who are struggling to pay the bills and have a decent standard of life for themselves and their families. You are helping. And what my argument today is, central government needs to do the same thing. We need to constrain our costs so we're able to let people have more of their own money to spend as they choose. So this year, for instance, you're going to be able to earn £10,000 before you start paying income tax. This year, if you're a business, you're going to get £2,000 off your national insurance contributions. We can only do that because we've taken difficult decisions to keep government costs under control. So I hope that other councils will follow your example. We've tried to help you by making sure that if you are pro-growth, you actually keep some of the resources that you generate. If you attract new businesses to the area, and I could see some quite important groundwork being done on my way from Rugby Station, you'll keep some of the extra business rates that those businesses bring. If you get more houses built here in Rugby, you'll keep the new homes bonus, and you can use that to keep your bills down. So this is a partnership between central government backing prudent and pro-growth local authorities so you can charge your residents less for their bills. One last question, gentleman here.
Hello, Prime Minister. Adam Lander, the MTC. With this being National Apprenticeship Week, what do you believe the perception is of apprenticeships? And do you feel that it's equal to that of university education?
I would argue, to be absolutely frank with you, we're not there yet, but I think we are getting there. I think there's some really good trends taking place. The first is that the growth of advanced apprenticeships that are equivalent to A-level, that is growing rapidly, and we've now got the higher level apprenticeships as well. So I think that's a very positive development. I think the new National Careers Service, which is going to have a very clear website for young people to access at school, that's going to set out the different paths you can take, whether it's doing A-levels and going to university or whether it's doing an apprenticeship, I think that will help as well. But I think it's a culture change that we need to make, and it's a culture change that needs to take place in every school, in every business, in every family in our country, which is to say that we should properly respect and give parity of esteem to vocational education. Now, government can help with that. We can fund more apprentices. We can fund amazing centres like this that demonstrate the importance of engineering and technology. We can set up, as we are, the university technical colleges that I think, like the one run by JCB, not a million miles from here, that give a great boost to vocational education. But culture change involves everybody. So it's a culture change that teachers and parents and businesses have all got to play a part of. But if we want to be a country that is more pro-manufacturing, pro-trade, pro-engineering, pro-making, selling, exporting, designing things, then it's a culture change we all need to take part, we all need to play our part in. I think we've gone a long way in a relatively short period of time. We're not there yet, but we'll get there. Can I thank you all again very much, and thank you for the warm welcome. Thank you for letting me come and speak in this extraordinary centre, where we are going to be training the apprentices of the future, developing and designing the technology and the products of the future. I see this as an important part of the reindustrialization of Britain, which here in the West Midlands, which was, of course, the manufacturing center of the world, I think it's great that this renaissance is taking place right here. So thank you very much again for coming. Thank you for the warm welcome. Take care.